Today on Maine Calling, a Your Vote 2024 election update. Have you voted yet? Many people have. In fact, as of yesterday, clerks say more than 165,000 Mainers have already turned in absentee ballots. What does this mean for the election, if anything? Is it an indication that a certain presidential candidate or candidate for Congress has an edge? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss those questions and more as we fast approach Election Day. Of course, Mainers aren't just voting on who to send to Washington, but also five statewide ballot initiatives, local reps, town council and school board members, and local initiatives such as school and conservation bonds. We discuss it all with Professors Dan Shea and Amy Freed and Maine Public State House reporter Kevin Miller. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. With the election now less than 2 weeks away, we turn to answering questions you may have about the various races, national and state, and local, as well as the referendum questions on the ballot. Joining me for this hour, Kevin Miller, who is State House correspondent, and my colleague here at Maine Public, Amy Freed, Professor Emerita of Political Science at the University of Maine. Her latest book, an edited collection of essays on New England politics called More Than Blue, More Than Yankee, Complexity and Change in New England Politics. And Dan Shea is a professor of government at Colby College. He has written widely on parties and elections. And his most recent book with co-author Nick Jacobs is The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. We invite you to join this conversation. Which races are you following? Have you already voted or made plans to vote? Share your comments and questions by email, a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to all of you, and thank you so much for joining us for this hour. I want to start with the Critical Insights poll that was just released yesterday. These are the fall 2024 survey results. One of the interesting findings is the race between Jared Golden and Austin Terrio in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. This survey indicates that the race is too close to call. Dan, I'll start with you. Is the race really that close?
Yeah, it's going to be that close. It's going to be a tight one. I think we should expect tight races across the country, including in the 2nd CD. It's interesting, throughout the country, there are very few split-ticket voters left. They're sort of on the endangered species list, but there have been sightings in northern Maine. That is to say, it's pretty clear that Donald Trump will win the 2nd CD. I think it'll be a big surprise if he doesn't. It may be closer than we think. It's not a lock. Well, if that's true, how could Jared Golden also be nip and tuck in that race? So there are a number of split ticket voters in Maine. We saw that 4 years ago with Susan Collins's race. I think Jared Golden's got to look for a lot of those.
When you say a split ticket voter, you mean somebody who doesn't vote all Democrat or all Republican?
Right. If they vote all Republican, then Terrio's got a new job, right? Because it's likely that Donald Trump will win in the 2nd. I don't want to say it's a foregone conclusion, but if everyone votes the same at the presidential level for the House, then Jared Golden will be in tough shape. But he's done that the past few elections. He continues to do that, and we could see that again. So that's what makes this race a bit unique. There aren't too many split ticket voters around.
Kevin, what are shaping up to be the big issues in that race? How are the candidates trying to define themselves in this final stretch?
Yeah, it's interesting because both candidates are basically trying to define themselves as independents or moderates or people who will work with people from both sides of the aisle. You know, in Jared Golden, he's been in Congress now for several terms. We've seen that that's pretty much the reputation that he's carved out for himself. He is perhaps, I guess, arguably the most conservative Democrat. He votes against his party more often than any other Democrat in the House, has voted against the Biden agenda more often than other Democrats. But at the same time, he's a pretty loyal Democrat when it comes to certain issues like abortion. So on the other side, we have Austin Terrio, who is a first-term Republican representative from Arosa County. He's a former NASCAR driver. He's young. He's also kind of describing himself as this moderate, you know, kind of middle-of-the-road guy that's willing to work with both parties and not be partisan. You know, and he doesn't have much of a track record. He's only been in the main House for about 2 years. But he is more moderate than a lot of other Republicans out there. So that's just an interesting dynamic, and I think goes to what Dan is saying. They're both trying to appeal to not only their party base, but that huge independent group or, you know, the potential split ticket voters.
Amy, when you watch the second district race, what is it that you're looking for?
Well, one thing that strikes me is that, you know, as I'm sure Dan could give the specific numbers, incumbents in the House tend to be reelected overwhelmingly. And Jared Golden has been a survivor in being able to do that in a very difficult circumstance. He did very well in 2020 relative to other Democrats in Trump districts. He did the best compared to, in terms of overperforming the share of the vote for the Democratic presidential candidate. And there's some advantages to incumbency. He's well known. I think second district voters know him as a person. So some of the ways to portray him as more extreme may not work quite as well as they would with a less known candidate or a new candidate in an open seat. But it is a difficult situation for him given the way that the second district has moved and become increasingly red.
Amy, I'll stick with you for this. The same survey shows, the Critical Insight survey indicates that although Kamala Harris seems to be leading the statewide vote in the presidential race, Donald Trump appears to be leading in the second district, as I think Dan has already alluded to. This is significant nationally because of the way Maine allocates electoral votes, correct?
Absolutely. There's only two states that allow for splitting electoral votes. The other is Nebraska. And in the case of Nebraska, it's widely assumed based on polling there that Harris will pick up one electoral vote and Trump will get the rest. So that, you know, kind of offsets what's likely to happen in our single electoral vote in the second district. Yeah, but it's, you know, it is a very unusual kind of system. I thought for a while perhaps people would be waiting for days to see how, you know, if there was a ranked choice. We now have ranked choice voting for electoral votes in Maine. Might be waiting and waiting, you know, because it takes a few days to figure it out. Who actually won in the second district? There were scenarios where, like, it really could make the ultimate difference in who wins the presidency. If this Critical Insight poll is correct, then it's fairly likely that won't happen. Probably Trump will win outright. But again, you know, we can't know for sure. You know, polls are only so good. And everyone should go vote and in all the races. And, you know, we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, just a second, Dan. We had pollster Andy Smith on Maine Calling just a couple weeks ago, and he basically said, we're all figuring it out, and polls are not, go ahead, Dan, and polls are not as accurate as they were 20 years ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of polling questions. Maybe we can get to that. Just a small historical tidbit that your listeners might be interested in. So the split of the electoral vote in Maine was done about 50 years ago in the 70s in order to give voters in the southern part of the state a say. It was a solidly Republican state, but Portland and South had become blue. So the original idea was to make it fair by giving the southern part of the state. And now, of course, it's the exact opposite. Just FYI, I think it's a good idea to keep it. I would be I it's a very main thing to do, it seems to me, to split the electoral votes.
Kevin, we have learned that more than 165,000 people have already voted in Maine, and that was yesterday's number. It could be even bigger today. When you hear that, and you've covered politics for a long time, what do you think?
Yeah, it certainly shows that, I mean, that this no excuse absentee voting process that we have here is, A, it's really popular, and that there is a decent amount of enthusiasm in this race. I mean, if you look back to 2 years ago, we had a gubernatorial election, and the number of absentee ballot requests is already higher. It was already higher as of earlier this year, or earlier this week, than it was for the 2022 election. This is a presidential election. Obviously, there's even more interest. Our use of the absentee ballot or kind of early voting is not as high as in 2020, but that's because we were in the middle of a pandemic. Everybody was voting remotely. So you can't really compare that. But this does suggest, and what the Secretary of State is saying is that this suggests there is a lot of enthusiasm here, and we're probably going to see high turnout, and potentially she's predicting, Shenna Bella, Secretary of State, is predicting that we'll probably be in the top three states nationally in terms of voter turnout. And there are some years when we are the number one state for voter turnout.
That's right. Isn't it usually Maine and Minnesota duking it out?
Right. Yep.
Amy, I want to know, when you hear that there are this many early voters, I know that sort of the conventional wisdom around the country is that that benefits Democrats. Is that indeed what happens here in Maine?
It's not necessarily true, and especially this year, because in 2020, there were big differences, at least around the country, in the partisan makeup of early voters, mail voters or absentee voters versus people who went on election day. And part of that were different reactions to the pandemic. Some of it was what because Donald Trump was down was saying that it wasn't a good way to vote by mail, that it was vulnerable to fraud. And encourage people to vote on election day. But now the Republican Party has been really supportive of doing absentee voting because they've realized that it's a good system, and a lot of people like to do it, and it makes it easier in some ways for the political parties because if they're trying to target voters who haven't yet voted, that then you can take a lot of people. And not have to go and find them because they already voted by mail. So it's, sort of less work in the last few days before election day to get people to go and contact voters if a substantial number have already voted.
Dan, you study rural voters, and I want to ask you, we have an unusual situation in the presidential race, and correct me if I'm wrong, have there ever been two vice presidential candidates who are really from rural areas? I mean, from small towns, and whether or not it's ever happened before or happened in recent history, how important is that to the people that you talk to?
Well, Jennifer, that's a tough trivia question. I think you got me on that one. I thought I knew a good bit about rural
Well, it
voters.
does seem in our lifetime, this is not the norm. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, well, here's the interesting thing. A lot of presidential candidates, top of the ticket and vice presidential, have been from small towns. That's more common than you'd think. So the great question is, well, I'm not sure J.D. Vance is from a small town. Middletown, Ohio is 50,000. So by Maine standards, that's a pretty big town. But all right, let's just say it's small. The great question is, will Tim Walz make a difference? I think there was a decision, or at least part of the decision in the Harris team, was try to break into the lock that Republicans seem to have in rural areas. I think Tim Walz was part of that. I think his convention speech and some comments that he's made about listening to people from these areas. I think Bill Clinton's comments, if you we were careful and listened to what he said, he also suggested that we have to be open-eared, we have to open our hearts to what people in rural areas are thinking. They're not all deplorables, they're not all crazy. Will it work? I'm not so sure about that this time around. I think it's going to be a slow transition back to the Democratic Party, but I know they're concerned about breaking into that lock at least a bit.
All right. Well, Kevin, we haven't even talked about the fact that everybody in the Maine legislature is up for re-election. Are there any particular races that you're watching, or are there any trends that you're watching?
Yeah, it's interesting. So right now, the Democrats have majorities in both the House and the Senate, and pretty comfortable majorities. And they can in the Senate, it's Democrats have a 12-seat majority out of 35 seats. And in the House, it's a 9-seat majority. But both parties are certainly behaving like the both chambers are in play right now. There's a lot of spending that's going on, especially in some key races. Ones that I think a lot of people are paying attention to. The district up in Aroostook County, the Senate district up in Aroostook County, that's currently held by Senate President Troy Jackson. He's termed out. Aroostook County used to be reliably Democrat. Now it's definitely leaning more Republican. So that's one district where there's a lot of attention being paid to. Here in the Augusta area, there's two districts that are kind of up in the air. Both of these are districts where the incumbent is not running. One is held by a Republican. One is held by a Democrat. And it's interesting, there are quite a few open seats this time around where you have incumbents who are either termed out or not running. And that's where it seems like we're seeing a lot of money being spent. Also seeing in the Windham area, some mid-coast districts. So definitely it seems like the like I said, the parties are behaving like these both chambers are potentially at play. Republicans would have to pick up a decent amount of seats, though, especially in the Senate, to flip control.
All right. Well, we have something unusual on the ballot this time around, and that is a referendum on the flag. And I'm wondering, Amy, do you think that the presence of this question on the ballot, whether to change the Maine state flag, affects voting patterns, affects who might turn out?
I don't think it really will. It's not, first of all, it is already a presidential year, so we're going to have strong turnout because of that. And then it's not one of those really high profile issues that's drawn a lot of advertising, a lot of attention, like things to do with gun control or hunting, which was related to gun control, or some of the social issues that tend to draw people out. So one interesting thing about that referendum is that all the polling shows that one is pretty evenly divided. And I don't know if it fits any partisan pattern behind it, because just in conversations with people and seeing things that people have said and written, I've seen people from both sides either liking the existing flag, preferring that one, or preferring the new one, which is that's sort of interesting in our day and age of great political polarization, if that turns out not to be particularly polarizing.
And it gives us something kind of fun to talk about in an election where there's a lot of things that are not very much fun to talk about. We do need to take a quick break. What are you thinking? What do you want to ask our experts? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the upcoming election. With me, Amy Freed, Professor Emerita of Political Science at UMaine, Dan Shea, Colby College Professor of Government, and Kevin Miller, Maine Public State House Correspondent. Share your comments and questions, our email address, and please keep an email brief, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Here's an email from John. Do you think Golden will see fallout this election after reversing his support for gun control after the Lewiston shooting last year? Dan Shea. Dan, are you
I
there?
think
Oh,
I,
go ahead.
yeah, I don't think so. I think that was such a horrific, tragic event. And his change of heart event, brought me to tears. I don't think he'll suffer from that. I don't think that'll happen for him. I think there are a number of other issues that that weigh on him, mostly his party's economy, inflation. And I think also, while it may not hit us directly, I think there are some very passionate attitudes on abortion. I'm sorry. Well, there is the abortion question, but also immigration. I think those two issues are tough for Democrats this time around, the cost of living and immigration. But on the other hand, there are some issues that work in his favor, like the abortion question. I know it's not a major driver in Maine, but it's on the minds of women in particular across the country. And I think he could see some strong support as a member of the Democratic Party that'll support reproductive rights. So
Kevin, what are
so your
yeah
question on gun control, I don't think so.
and what are your thoughts, Kevin?
Yeah, so I think the gun issue is certainly an interesting one. The Republicans have been hitting him really hard, as anyone who watches TV or sees on any of these digital ads, they've just been hammering him about basically abandoning the Second Amendment and flip-flopping on this issue. But if you look at Jared Golden's record, yes, he has changed his perspective on this, but he's still, and he even says, he's still pretty reliably moderate to conservative on other gun issues. Like, for instance, he said that he would not, I think he told you, Jen, in an earlier interview, that he would not have supported a lot of the laws that passed the Maine legislature this year. So he's tried to make that clear that, he has a more nuanced position on guns. I guess the question then comes down to how effective are the Republican ads? Because they're basically, I think one even calls him a turncoat. Golden's a former Marine, combat tested Marine Corps veteran. So for folks to be calling him a turncoat, I'm sure does not sit well with him on this issue. But so it all depends on how effective the ads are and how effective he is as and kind of reminding folks where he stands on most gun issues.
Amy.
Yeah, I don't think it necessarily will have an impact. It could have a little bit, in a close race, everything matters. But one thing that I've been thinking about with this race is that currently there are no Republicans in the U.S. House from New England, which is part of a long pattern. There's only one U.S. senator who is a Republican from New England, of course. That's our Susan Collins. I think that's that kind of pattern could be broken in this race, in which case, you'd have Austin Terrio going as a one member, probably a one member Republican caucus from New England, because I don't know of any other races that I've heard in New England that Republicans are competitive for. And he would, I think, to do well, have to be thinking about issues that are, relevant, of course, to the district, Maine and New England more generally.
We'll go to Bob, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Bob, go ahead.
Hello. My question is about polling, and I have a feeling that the polling isn't as close as it shows in the presidential election. And I'd like to get a comment on my question here is the fact I don't think it's as close as Trump getting as many votes as people he's polling to get, because I believe that there's people out there who are afraid to say that they're anti-Trumpers, they're not going to vote for Trump because of the history of retaliation and anti-Trump people getting targeted by the Republican Party. Do you think there's a bit of a factor of that if you get a survey or a phone call from a stranger, are you really going to say that you're not voting for Trump? But when you pull that curtain behind you, you're going to drop a vote for Harris?
Bob,
I'm
yeah,
curious
thank you
about.
for that question. Amy, what do you think?
This is really a tough one because the last two elections that when Trump ran, last two presidential elections, he outperformed the polls. He did better than the polling. So a lot of people think even if the polling looks close, he might overperform. On the other hand, pollsters have made changes in how they've done polling. There was a really good rundown of this in the New York Times the other day, And so some people think that, you know, maybe these are a lot more accurate. Plus, there's a, to make it even more complicated, there's a history. And if you look back at polling and presidential elections, where they don't tend to be wrong in the same direction more than two times. And this would, you know, be the third time. I find it very, very difficult to know what's happening in this race based on the polling. Also, you know, an additional sort of factor is general enthusiasm and efforts to promote turnout that the different campaigns are doing. And the general understanding that people have, and this could also be wrong, is that Democrats are doing much more in terms of get out the vote operations, while Republicans have pulled back on that and are investing more in trying to challenge votes, you know, after the election, bringing lawsuits and such. And the kind of turnout operations don't make a huge difference. Like, it's not going to change things by 5 points or even 3 percentage points, but it could change things by 0.5 point, 1 point, 1.5. And in very close elections, that could be the margin.
Dan.
Yeah, I would add just a little bit. So yes, Amy's right. So the problem in the last couple elections, it's what's called the non-response bias. And what happened was the same type of person that was least likely to answer a poll would be more likely to vote for Donald Trump. So that's how we missed a lot of Trump voters. But Amy's right, pollsters are onto that. So they're using some different ways to make sure they've got it right. They're doing two things. They're using education as a weighted measure, which is a fascinating story. Education has become one of the lead demographic predictors of vote choice. So they never used to weigh respondents by education. In other words, make sure that they're balanced by education. They're doing that now. And they're also using the previous vote choice as a way of balancing it. That is to say, if it's a sort of a complicated story, but in short, there are new ways to try to get at this non-response bias. I think Amy's right. I would be surprised if they were wrong three times in a row. Here's what's also interesting about it is, given that we've got seven swing states that are within a point or two, it's entirely likely that all seven could in reality go for one of the candidates. In other words, if it is wrong in either direction, it could be a sweep. It's hard to imagine that there would be wrong in some states, but not others. It might be a systematic error that leads to a sweep. Mm. I have a suspicion your caller was looking for that sort of a sweep in a particular direction.
Yeah, you know, when we're talking about potentially undercounted voters or sectors, and I'm wondering, Amy, how you feel about women and whether you believe more women will vote this time for two reasons. One, because of what we're seeing with the overturning of Roe versus Wade, but also because there is a woman at the top of the ticket for one of the major parties.
Well, I definitely expect to see a strong vote from women. And it's been actually decades, very long time since women have been a majority of the electorate. Actually, when women first got the vote, they didn't vote that much. You know, it took a while to get to the point where women matched men as a percentage of them voting. But women have been voting for, you know, decades as a higher percentage of the electorate than men. But there's been extraordinary interest, and we see also voter registration numbers in some states where women are really outpacing men. And a lot of that is due to Dobbs, the decision that overturned Roe v. Wade.
All right, I'm going to go to a question here about ranked choice voting. This is from Starin, an email. I'm curious to know if there are strategies people have to maximize their first choice candidates' chances in this presidential and congressional elections. Rank only your first choice, rank all of the candidates, or something in between. Has this been around long enough? I'll turn to you, Dan. Have we studied like how people are trying to, if you will, game their vote, or are most people just going in there and voting for one candidate?
Well, one of the downsides to ranked choice voting is that it's still a bit complicated for folks. And if you're going to vote first for one of the top two candidates, it really doesn't make much sense, your ranked choice. It's not a strategic decision, right? It only becomes a strategic decision if you're voting for a minor party candidate, right? Because it's entirely it won't matter. And that's interesting, and that's honestly one of the downsides to ranked choice voting. I had a person call me recently who was passionately backing one of the major candidates and was asking about the ranked choice process. And I said, well, if you're going to vote for one of the two major party candidates, it actually doesn't matter. Your ranked choice doesn't matter. So even that might be puzzling to a number of our listeners, but that's, again, that's the reality of that process. It only matters if you're voting for a minor party candidate or a three-way race that's very, very tight.
All right, we're going to go to Kurt, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Kurt, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going today, Jennifer?
Good.
Good. I'm just calling quickly to speak in favor of question two. I'm with Ready Seafood right in Saco, and a similar initiative back in 2018 was really a groundbreaking impact on our business. We are a live and processed lobster company based right in Portland and Saco. And like I said, a similar bond initiative provided us with funding through a surprisingly highly competitive grant process through MTI that allowed us to really build a new processing plant with all this really cool technology that helped us develop new Maine lobster products and reach new markets with those. So this funding was really the spark that lit a fire in our company of growth. And there are so many Maine companies right now that are just on that cusp that we were at back in 2018 and could really benefit from an initiative just like this. And ultimately, it'll pay dividends for our state just like it did back in 2018. So just wanted to give that a plug, and I really appreciate the time.
Kurt, thank you so much for calling in. Kurt Brown from Ready Seafood in support of the bond initiative question two. Amy, traditionally, I know it's not always, but traditionally, Mainers do vote yes for bond issues, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's really overwhelmingly that Maine people do vote for bond issues. Professor Jim Melcher of UMaine Farmington has done a few papers on this, breaking it down. And the only ones that have failed over the years are ones that are very, very narrow, like about a specific place. If they're broad, you know, even if it's, you know, one particular type of spending, you know, whether it's transportation, research and development, you know, the other sorts of things also that are on the ballot, like the trails, the historic buildings, things like that tend to do well. It's only if it's like, let's get funding for a port in this particular place, then statewide, people don't feel the same attraction to voting on that kind of bond spending.
Kurt, thanks for calling in again. I'm going to go here to a little comment question from Lynn on Facebook. When are early votes counted/tabulated? Kevin, how does it work? When do local clerks vote count those early ballots?
Well, they typically vote them on election day. I think there are processes where they can start early, but you know, a lot of towns, they wait until election day and start kind of running through the machine then.
Yeah, my understanding from staying up on election nights is often the first votes you see coming in are the votes from that same day, and then the later ones are the counting of the absentee ballots. Am I right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we are going to take another quick break. We're having a conversation about the upcoming election. I'm sure you know there's an upcoming election. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a quick email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing the November election. My guests are Dan Shea, Colby College political science professor, Kevin Miller, Maine Public State House correspondent, and you, Maine Professor Emerita of Political Science, Amy Freed. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We're going to go to a post from Joe on Facebook. This summer, Maine joined the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. This means all Maine's electoral votes go to the winner of the national popular vote. I don't know if this would split the three electoral votes Maine has, but I understand it to not split the vote. Kevin, walk us through this.
Yes, there is. So National Popular Vote is a national movement that would basically mean just that, that whoever wins the most votes nationwide would be elected president, as opposed to the electoral college system that we have now. This compact is basically, it's a process for states to pledge to offer all their electoral college votes to whoever wins the national popular vote. What the issue here is that this, and Maine actually did, the Maine legislature passed a bill this past year saying, yeah, we're going to join the National Popular Vote Compact and we're going to go along with this. But it only kicks in once enough states reach the threshold of 270 electoral college votes that a president needs. Right now, it looks like they're at about 209. So the National Popular Vote Compact really does not kick in at this stage. Few years down the line, if enough other states also join, then yes, Maine would add its votes to whoever wins the popular vote. But at this point, it's not gonna apply in this election because they're still short of the 270 they need to get the popular vote.
All right, thanks, Kevin. Yeah. Dan.
Yeah, it's called the Maryland Plan as well. It started in Maryland. It's an interesting idea. It's a way to nullify the Electoral College without changing the Constitution. The snag is that it has become a partisan issue, and it's hard to imagine Republican legislatures dominated by Republicans moving on this. I think it's a really interesting, important idea, but the prospects of seeing it happen, I think, are pretty dim at this point.
And would you say, Dan, that the reason it's become a partisan issue is because recently there have been more than one presidential races in which the Democrat has won the popular vote, but the Republican has won the electoral vote?
I would be very surprised if Kamala Harris doesn't win the popular vote this time around. And not saying she's going to win the electoral college, but I would be very surprised. There have been some changes. There's no doubt about it. A lot being written about it leveling off a bit from 2020 and 2016. But I would be very surprised if she loses the popular vote this time around. And she could still obviously lose the Electoral College vote.
Amy.
Yeah, I do think that the partisanship is related to that in both 2000 and 2016. Republicans were elected president, but lost the popular vote. And that, you know, especially with the most recent case of that, I think there's actually, you know, a possibility, who knows how big, that it could turn out the other way. Because if, you know, Trump makes some inroads in New York and California, some big states like that, make them closer, but Harris still wins them, which we would expect Harris to win both. And the environment, the political environment within the swing states is actually somewhat different from nationally. I mean, it's affected by national currents, but there's so much more advertising, so much more outreach, so much more involvement on the ground in field operations. There's a possibility it could turn out the other way. And that would really lead to some very interesting post-election views about the Electoral College. I think Dan's right. It probably won't be like that, you know, where Trump somehow manages to win the popular vote and lose the Electoral College. But I don't think it's completely out of the picture. And there is some recent polling that, you know, shows him with a small lead nationally and yet very, very tight, or even Harris ahead in some of the swing states.
An email here from Jim. Golden participated in this program explaining his thinking. Terrio did not. Days later, Golden sat for an interview with several Maine newspapers and addressed several of his challenging decisions. Terrio did not. We have no idea where Terrio stands. Jim is correct. Terrio was the only candidate for Congress or Senate who did not appear on Maine Calling. Dan, this is, though, part of a bigger conversation about how much media ought candidates be doing. A lot of criticism, first of Kamala Harris, now of Donald Trump, and who they're sitting down for interviews and what kind of questions they're being asked. And I want to ask you, Dan, do the voters care?
I think they do care. It's interesting. It's turned on its head a little bit. It used to be that challengers would do anything to get media attention, right? Because Amy's right. She mentioned earlier that there's huge incumbent advantage. So Jared Golden's been doing news, being in the news, you know, all the time for the past 6 years. He's in the news. So Terrio, you would think, would want to grab anything that he could get. But the problem is when you go on shows like this or you do interviews, it's not controlled, right? So you lose control of the message. There could be an oddball question. There could be something that you're not prepared to answer, right? The easier route or the safer route is to do your own media, right? To do your own ads. Historically, that's not the preferred method because it doesn't have as legitimacy. You know, sitting down with Jennifer Rooks is really a powerful sort of legitimate outlet, but you lose control. So my guess is what he's trying to do is keep his message exactly the way he'd like, and you do that through paying for media and not getting earned or free media.
All right, let's see. We will go to Anne, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Anne, go ahead.
Hi there. Just an observation. It has blown my mind that Democrats in general and Kamala Harris in particular do not point out that it's not, quote unquote, the economy. It's income inequality that is making so many people suffer and has been for years, just getting worse. Anyway, that's my observation. Thanks.
Interesting, Anne. I'll turn to you, Amy. How come that's not a slogan? That's not something that is talked about over and over again, income inequality on the Democrat side? Clearly, there's a reason.
Yeah, that is a very interesting question. I mean, you'd have to say that the people running these campaigns have, in doing their research, found that that's sort of not where a lot of voters are right now. And you could say it's a lack of, I think our caller, Anne, would say it's a lack of political leadership for them to say, well, nonetheless, we want to talk about it. I think there's a kind of indirect way that Harris has talked about it, but not in this exact way, which is that She said a lot about creating, she uses the phrase opportunity economy. That's I haven't really heard that specific phrase before. And she's also talked a lot about people being able to start businesses and create intergenerational wealth. But really the idea of opportunity is that there are some people who lack opportunity, right? And we know that if you're already from a middle class or upper middle class family, your kids are probably going to do at least as well as you in general. But there's not a lot of movement between it from one generation to another often when it comes to class. So people from lower income families, they often stay lower income. People from very wealthy families, they do very well. So I'd say, yeah, she's not talking about income inequality, but she is talking about opportunity, which is a sort of another lens. And Americans in general like the idea of opportunity a lot. And, there used to be a lot of talk about, what equality that people don't like equal outcomes, like saying there must be equal outcomes with the kind of, when people talked about affirmative action, but they like the idea of equal opportunity. And opportunity leaves it open for a lot of effort of individuals to go out and work hard with the right circumstances. And that could include certain support and when it comes to education, other kinds of government programs. And then they create their own wealth and their own advantages.
Dan.
Yeah, I would just add real quickly, I think we would have heard a bit more about income inequality if there was a spirited Democratic primary. Right. So she jumped right into the general election. So the rhetoric, the verbiage that's used in the general election is different than what we would have heard in a Democratic primary.
All right. And Kevin, I know you wanted to return to the topic of absentee voting. We had a question from one of our listeners about when absentee votes are counted.
Yeah, and I just wanted to make sure I went back to make sure I had this correct. The actual ballots are not counted until after election day, until the polls close on election day. But there is early processing in towns. And I went and I looked as we were talking, and there are actually quite a large number of towns that can start the processing. Start the process earlier, which is when they take them out of the envelope, they unfold them, they put them in a box, and they may even put them into the tabulator, but they're not actually counted. So all votes are counted after the polls close on election day, but the process can actually start if a town gets early approval to do that. And if that happens, partisan poll watchers can be there, or invited to be there, and to watch this whole process.
All right. We'll go to Rena, who's calling from Hollowell. Hi, Rena. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I'm old, senile, and crotchety, but I care about my state of Maine. I started out in the first district, but then I came south to earn a living, and now I'm back in the second district. There's so many lies told by a slumlord and somebody that got into politics for revenge to begin with. And I don't understand why the people in the second northern part of the second district believe everything that he says. Lies upon lies upon lies.
Dan, this is something that you've studied. Why? I think a lot of people believe that in another era, someone who's a convicted felon would not be a viable candidate for president. What's different today?
Well, there is a couple things. I think we should remember that not all Trump voters are wild supporters of Donald Trump. That is to say, they have a great deal of skepticism about the Democratic Party. And much of what we find is that the story of the movement of rural voters to the Republican ranks predates Donald Trump. It's really not about Donald Trump. It's skepticism about the Democratic Party. So I think that's an important part of it. And the other thing I would say is, I often say all Americans are sort of anxious about their future, about what's happening in America. Take that anxiety, double it, and extend it back two decades, and that's what you get in the rural America. So it has been a tough number of decades, and somehow, and I'm not saying this is factually correct, they've come to believe that the root problem is that Democrats have turned their back on rural America. So in places like the second district, they want, I could argue that they want change. They want a disruptor. They want something different. And Donald Trump is nothing if not a disruptor.
And Dan, I want to return to this idea of how a rural voter might think, because I'm wondering if what you found is that Maine really reflects the nation at large. I think probably a lot of Mainers would not want to hear that. We think of ourselves as independent-minded. But in your research, what have you found?
Well, I think that Maine's outcome winds up being pretty similar to the national outcome, but there are really deeper divisions throughout the country than we see in Maine. I think Maine winds up moving towards the center. I know for some of your listeners, you might be surprised about that, but that we have, you know, a split outcome that in 2020, the only state after a long period of split outcomes where the Senate, member of the Senate that's elected is different from the president of that year. That happened over and over, then it stopped. And that we wound up with Susan Collins being elected easily in a state that Joe Biden wins easily, says a lot about the moderate sort of coming together attitude of Mainers. I think, to be honest, Jennifer, I think we're unique, and I do hope that we hang on that.
Well, Rena, I thank you for your last call of the hour, and Dan for that comment, and I apologize to those of you we were not able to get to. Thank you to our guest, Dan Shea, a professor of government at Golby College. His most recent book with co-author Nick Jacobs is called the rural voter. Amy Fried, a professor emerita, political science at UMaine, her latest book, a collection of essays on New England politics called More Than Blue, More Than Yankee. And Kevin Miller, Maine Public's State House correspondent. Today's sound engineer was Jess Miller. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we talk about the one-year anniversary of the Lewiston tragedy and the communities it affected. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.